Hey, welcome to the Grossdummy summary of 1984 by George Orwell. 1984 is a novel about a terrifying future where everyone is controlled by a totalitarian political party led by a man called Big Brother. George Orwell predicted many real-life methods of government overreach, including strict censorship, mass surveillance, thought police, manipulation of language, and rewriting history. Our top quote from this book is, "Who controls the past controls the future. Who controls the present controls the past." And looking at the online reviews for this book, on Amazon it has 4.7 stars, and on Goodreads it has 4.2 stars. Positive reviewers said that it's a frightening and eye-opening book that illustrates the importance of our individual liberties. But there were some critical reviewers who said the novel's characters are kind of thin, and they also believe some people apply the ideas in this book too quickly when there's any new government law. So let's begin. Scary. Frightening. Terrifying. That's what many people who read 1984 say about it. Why? Because this book imagines what life would be like under an all-powerful government. A government that sees everything, controls everyone, and even punishes people for having the wrong thoughts. Big Brother, thought police, the Ministry of Truth. Many powerful ideas from this book by George Orwell have become a part of our regular language, and that may be why it's generally seen as one of the most influential books of all time, a true literary classic. I remember reading 1984 in high school, as many teenagers do. Reading it again as an adult, it made an even stronger impression on me. Because today it is no longer imaginary that recording devices are with us everywhere, in our smartphones, for example. It's no longer imaginary that private data that we have is often secretly tracked. I mean, just look at the 2013 leaks about the NSA, National Security Agency in the US. And it's also not imaginary that public conversation is mostly controlled on a few central platforms, like Facebook and Twitter. So what is 1984 about exactly? Well, here's an overview of the three parts. Part one is an introduction to the main characters and the future dystopia they live in, which is called Oceania. The main character, Winston Smith, lives in a future London controlled by a political party named Ingsoc. Then part two is about Winston's secret love affair with a woman named Julia. Because the party strictly controls all romantic relationships, the two must dodge constant surveillance and thought police. And then part three is about Winston's arrest and torture. He is tortured and re-educated to love Big Brother. So who was George Orwell? He was born in 1903 in British India. And he wrote many timeless books, including his most famous ones, 1984 and Animal Farm. Oppressive governments sometimes banned his books because of their political message, and I'm sure he saw that as a compliment. Now, to understand where Orwell is coming from, you must know that in his younger years he fought in the Spanish Civil War against fascists and nationalists. But over time, he became disillusioned by the people on the other side too, the communists and the extreme socialists, especially after he saw, with his own eyes, the Soviet Union transform under Stalin into a totalitarian state, which was no less evil than the fascists he'd been fighting against. So let's begin with lesson number one from this book, which is Big Brother. The leader of a totalitarian political party controls all parts of life. Big Brother is watching you. Read the posters that can be seen everywhere over London. On top of that message, there's a face with a thick black mustache. It's the face of Big Brother, the political leader of the party that controls everything. The posters are there to remind everyone that the state, led by Big Brother, is always watching over them. Now, here are some quick facts. The setting of 1984 is an imaginary future London. It's no longer part of England, but a larger state called Oceania. Now, this book was written in 1948, so back then, 1984 would have been the future. And the main character, as mentioned before, is Winston Smith. He's a 39-year-old who works a mid-level government job, and he's always wearing the blue overalls mandated by the party. And the story, in general, is about how Winston begins to feel discontent and then rebel against the party. He feels troubled about how they control everyone and how everybody else appears to be happily obedient. Now, many people would call the government of this book totalitarian, and that's defined by Cambridge Dictionary as, quote, a political system in which those in power have complete control and do not allow people freedom to oppose them, end quote. So in this world, London is described as a place where everything is old, dirty, gray, and falling apart. Actually, everything but four huge gleaming white buildings, which rise above everything. Those buildings are home to the government's four ministries. First, there's the Ministry of Truth. They control all the media, newspapers, films, education, and historical records. In other words, they control the official truth, which is usually outright lies. Second is the Ministry of Peace. They're in charge of war, soldiers, bombings. Hardly peaceful. Third is the Ministry of Love. They're kind of like a police or a law. They torture and force confessions out of political prisoners. They punish and re-educate people who don't think correctly according to the party. And fourth is the Ministry of Plenty. They control the economy and publish constant propaganda about how great everything is, while in reality, people are starving and there are always huge shortages of basic products like razor blades and shoes. So as you can see, the names of these four ministries are very strange. The ministries actually do the opposite of what they are labeled or called. And this is a big theme in 1984. Language is used not to communicate, but to conceal, not to express the truth, but to hide it. When people such as politicians do this today, it's often called double speak, and that's a word directly inspired by George Orwell decades ago. So let's talk more about the party. Their official name is INGSOC, which is short for English Socialism. So it started as some kind of socialist party and then transformed into a totalitarian. And they split society into three classes of people. First class of people is the inner party. This is 2% of the population. The inner party are the leaders, and they enjoy privileges not available to the other classes, including luxury apartments and real food that is high quality. The second class is the outer party, which is about 13% of the population. These are all party employees, government state employees, who are carefully monitored and brainwashed into the party's thinking. Their homes are not nearly as good. They're usually falling apart, and their food tastes much worse. And finally, we have the largest class of people, the proles, which are 85% of the population. The name is short for proletariat, which means working class people. And they are more poor and less educated. They're controlled mostly not through brainwashing, but through endless distraction, like exhausting work, gambling, and lots of junk entertainment. Now, 1984 is often compared to another book called Brave New World by Aldous Huxley. Both of these books talk about terrible future dystopias, but there's one big difference. In 1984, the evil rulers stay in power through surveillance, force, and pain. But in that book, Brave New World, the rulers use pleasure, distraction, and intoxication. So in many ways, that vision of the future is even more disturbing. And that author, Aldous Huxley, wrote, quote, "There will be, in the next generation or so, a pharmacological method of making people love their servitude, and producing dictatorship without tears, so to speak, so that people will in fact have their liberties taken away from them, but will rather enjoy it, because they will be distracted." End quote. And we will hopefully have a summary of that book, Brave New World, coming in the future. To summarize this first lesson, in an imaginary future London, a political party named Ingsoc controls everything, and they're led by the mustached leader Big Brother, who is seen on posters everywhere. A mid-level party worker named Winston Smith is feeling unhappy because conditions are bad, homes are shabby, food tastes terrible, and product shortages are common. Next, we have lesson two, the Thought Police. They enforce order with mass surveillance and heavy punishment for thought crime. So people's thinking and speech are carefully controlled by the party in this book, so that the party can maintain power and prevent any future rebellions. Controlling thinking starts with childhood education, and it's reinforced with daily propaganda. And controlling speech is about censoring any ideas that go against the party or against the leadership. And then they also watch everybody almost all the time, even in their homes. In chapter one of this book, Winston starts writing a diary in an old blank book he found in a junk shop. Now, in the world of 1984, this is a dangerous act because it's a thought crime that could lead to 25 years of punishment in a labor camp. And Winston actually believed from the very beginning that he would eventually be caught for this crime, saying to himself, "Thought crime is death." So thought crime is the name for any thinking that goes against the political authorities or orthodoxy. People who commit these thought crimes, who have wrong thoughts, they're often vaporized, which means they disappear suddenly and all records of their existence are erased. In fact, 20 or 30 years before in this world, there were some great purges where thousands of people were suddenly vaporized, including Winston's own mother. Let's talk about some of the creepy methods of mass surveillance mentioned in 1984. First are the Thought Police. These are undercover agents that are secretly watching everywhere. They actively hunt down people who don't seem to completely conform to all the party's beliefs. Second are spies. Children are trained to be spies in organizations that resemble the Boy Scouts today. And they're even praised in state newspapers as child heroes when they turn in their own parents for thinking that goes against the party. In fact, in chapter 2, Winston visits a neighbor, Miss Parsons, whose children are running around in these official child spy uniforms, and they're pretending to viciously shoot traitors of the state. And he mentions that many parents are now afraid of their own kids. A third method of surveillance are telescreens. These are found in each home. They're two-way electronic screens. And they're found in hallways and workplaces and in each apartment. So that party members are being watched all the time by the Thought Police for any signs of disagreement or nonconformity. Even a slight lack of enthusiasm towards some new propaganda could be punishable for something they call face crime. Now, let's talk about this idea. Societies always need to strike some balance between order and freedom. This is true in real life, too. But it's obvious that the party in 1984 went way too far in one direction of order and control. Now, there's a famous modern psychologist named Jordan Peterson who talks about a related idea, how parents need to strike the right balance between safety and freedom while raising their kids. In his best-selling book, 12 Rules for Life, Peterson wrote, "Question for parents, do you want to make your children safe or strong?" End quote. And as an example, he advises not to bother children who are doing something a little risky that expands their abilities, such as skateboarding. So, we have to consider that. It's important to keep children safe, but is it possible that protecting someone too much will block them from developing their competence and confidence that are necessary for adulthood? Those are character traits that are needed to live a fulfilled life in a world that unavoidably contains risks. So to hear more ideas like that, check out our summary of the book 12 Rules for Life by Jordan Peterson. So let's go back to this diary that our main character was writing. First, he writes down the date of 1984. And then he writes down his experiences going to the movie theater recently. He was watching a violent war film, basically a propaganda film about destroying enemy soldiers. And then he describes in the diary a daily ritual they have called the 2 Minutes Hate. And basically, a group of party members get together, they set up some chairs in front of a big screen, and then they stand and yell angrily at the big screen, which is showing a video of the state's biggest enemy, a man named Emmanuel Goldstein. So over 2 minutes, the party members steadily shout more and more angrily until everyone is filled with rage and even throwing objects at the screen. And that's called the 2 minutes hate. George Orwell uses this memory to introduce some of the main characters of the book, including first, Julia. So for a few chapters, she is simply called the dark-haired girl. She's always wearing the blue overalls of the party, just like Winston, but she has a red sash around her waist that shows she is a member of something called the Junior Anti-Sex League, which is kind of like an especially fanatical group inside the party. Winston suspects that she could be a spy or a thought police, and secretly he hates her because she does seem to be so committed to the party thinking. The next character mentioned is a man named O'Brien, who also shows up to the 2 minutes hate. He's an intelligent, powerfully built man, a member of the privileged inner party. Based on some short looks between them, like they make eye contact sometimes, Winston suspects that O'Brien is not completely in agreement with the party. And the third character is Emmanuel Goldstein, the main subject on the screen during the 2 minutes hate. He's a man with glasses and a short goatee, and history says that he began as a top leader in the party, but then he became a traitor. Now, they say he's a leader of a shadowy organization called the Brotherhood that's actively trying to destroy the party, and they're working together with foreign enemies of other countries. Now let's analyze this for a minute. Most people agree that 1984 was greatly inspired by what the real-life Communist Party of the Soviet Union did. Today, that would be Russia. Big Brother was obviously meant to resemble Joseph Stalin, the brutal leader of the communists, who also had a big mustache. Goldstein resembles Trotsky, who was an early communist revolutionary leader, who later went against the Stalin government and then was exiled from the country. And even many of the tactics that the communists used were the same as in this book, like erasing people from historical photos and encouraging children to snitch on their parents. So to summarize the second lesson, any unorthodox thinking, any thinking that goes against the party, is called thought crime. And it's heavily suppressed, censored, and punished. People are always monitored by thought police, citizen spies, child spies, and telescreens that are always watching. Despite the risks, Winston begins writing a secret diary of his thoughts. Lesson 3 is the Ministry of Truth. Winston's job is to rewrite history in support of the party. So at 7:15 each morning, the telescreen in Winston's apartment whistles to wake him up, and then it guides him through physical exercises called the physical jerks. Then Winston, like all the other office workers, goes to his job, and he's working at the Ministry of Truth, a building with 3,000 rooms and endless rows of cubicles. Winston's job at the Ministry of Truth is to rewrite past records according to what the party is saying today. The old versions of the records are destroyed by being dropped into a memory hole on the side of Winston's desk, and then the version that he has corrected is placed into the official archives. And the records they modify include all the past newspapers, books, films, photographs, and speeches. For example, in Chapter 4, Winston rewrites one of Big Brother's old speeches to remove any mention of a man named Comrade Withers, who had recently committed a thought crime, and so he needed to be vaporized or erased from all records. So any mention of him in newspapers or any image of him in photos had to be erased. The party's goal in rewriting history all the time was to help them stay in control. According to the records, no person or idea had ever existed that contradicted what the party was saying. The Ministry of Plenty, for example, was always publishing news and propaganda about how much better life was becoming and how great the economy was doing. Yet in real life, what Winston saw were constant shortages of basic things like shoes and buttons. In fact, 50% of people walked without shoes, despite the propaganda saying there were record production of shoes all the time. And the food they ate smelled bad, and everything was generally old, dirty, and gray. Totally the opposite of the propaganda. But since all the records were changed, Winston struggled to remember whether life was really worse before the party came into power, like all the history books claimed. Later on, in Chapter 8, Winston tries to speak with a man in a pub, an old man, to find out if life was really worse before. But the old man can't remember much. He's kind of declining in health. And so all he can give Winston are incoherent, rambling answers. And so Winston realized that as people's memories fade and the older people die, the lies of the party would pass into history. In fact, George Orwell wrote a stunning paragraph about this. Here's a quote. "Every record has been destroyed or falsified. Every book has been rewritten. Every picture has been repainted. Every statue and street and building has been renamed. Every date has been altered. And that process is continuing day by day and minute by minute. History has stopped. Nothing exists except an endless present in which the party is always right." End quote. Okay, so here's one more important part of the book related to this idea. There was one time Winston did find concrete proof of one of the party's lies. You see, there were three men named Jones, Aronson, and Rutherford. They were early revolutionary leaders, but were later accused of being traitors. So in 1965, they were arrested and they confessed to their crimes. But years later, Winston saw them drinking at a cafe, drinking alcohol, and noticed their noses had been broken, which was implying a forced confession in the book. And then later, while he was working, Winston discovered a photo of the men that contradicted the confession they made, because it showed they'd been in a different place than they had said during the confession. So basically, it was proof that their confession had been forced and it was false. But Winston kind of panicked a little bit, and he quickly threw the photo down the memory hole out of fear. So to summarize Lesson 3, Winston's job at the Ministry of Truth is to correct old records and make them match the party's current propaganda. The newspapers, books, films, and other media are all continuously rewritten. There is no more history, but only ever-changing and convenient lies. So next we have Lesson 4, Newspeak. The party controls thinking by controlling language and what words people are allowed to use. So in Chapter 5, during a work break, Winston goes to eat at an underground cafeteria. He begins talking to a coworker named Syme, who is working on the next version of the dictionary of Newspeak. Newspeak is the official language of Oceania, and it's slowly replacing English, which is also called Old Speak. Newspeak is a language designed not to add words, but to remove them from people's vocabulary. And the end goal of it is to make some thoughts impossible to have, which will prevent thought crime. For example, how can we talk about freedom if we never learned about the idea or have a name for it? And in the book, they mention people in the future would be totally unable to understand past literature, like Shakespeare. Now, there are some interesting words in this language called Newspeak. Here are three of them. First, good thinker. That means an orthodox person who mindlessly trusts the party. Second, double plus good. That's a compound word that replaces a lot of other words like excellent and great. So the idea is to remove a lot of shades of gray in language and just make it simple words. A third word is old think. That's the name for outdated thinking, such as a belief that history exists outside of the party's records and brainwashing. Now, it's important to understand that George Orwell did not invent the idea behind Newspeak. He simply saw what totalitarian governments were already doing, especially the communists in the Soviet Union, aka Russia, and then he exaggerated it. And the idea of controlling language continues to be relevant today, especially whenever we hear a politician or a lobbyist or maybe an activist redefining words for their political purposes. So to summarize this lesson, the official language of Oceania is Newspeak, which is slowly replacing English. The purpose of Newspeak is to remove words from people's vocabulary so they cannot have some thoughts, like they won't be able to understand the idea of freedom or what past literature even said. And next is Lesson 5, Double Think. People were trained to accept contradictory facts, even that 2 plus 2 equals 5. So 2 plus 2 equals 5, that is obviously wrong, but it's the best example in the book of what's called reality control. The party believes that if they say 2 plus 2 equals 5, and can make everyone agree that 2 plus 2 equals 5, through force and brainwashing, then 2 plus 2 will really equal 5. How is that possible? Through doublethink. Doublethink means a party member being taught to accept contradictory facts without any resistance. They're taught mental techniques to be able to do this, such as Crime Stop, which immediately freezes any kind of rational questioning they have of what authorities are saying. Here's a quote. The party told you to reject the evidence of your eyes and ears. It was their final, most essential command. End quote. For example, the world of 1984 is divided into three superstates, which are called Oceania, Eurasia, and East Asia. 4 years ago, the state of Oceania, that Winston lives in, was at war with East Asia. But then, the enemy changed to Eurasia, suddenly. And when that happened, all the records were changed to say that they had always been at war with Eurasia. And people simply accepted that. And in the middle of part 2 in this book, There's an even more dramatic example of this doublethink. In the present, there was a large patriotic celebration called Hate Week, and for 1 week, everybody in London was raging at their enemy, which at the time was Eurasia. But midway through the week, right in front of Winston's eyes, the party decided to change the enemy to East Asia. So everybody was out on the street, yelling about their worst enemy, Eurasia, and then the party says the enemy is East Asia, and it's always been East Asia, and all the party members in the streets accepted it. They had been so well trained in doublethink that they instantly accepted the change. And after that happened, Winston spent 1 week working overtime at his job to change all the records from the last 4 years to say that they had always been at war with East Asia. So 2 plus 2 equals 5, reality control. It's one of the most disturbing ideas in the book. But what's even more disturbing is when Winston asks, what if the party is right? The party claims that past history only exists in the records and in people's minds, and if the party controls both of those, the records and people's minds, then maybe they do really control reality. But in the end, Winston strongly rejects that idea. He believes there is still an objective truth of what happened, even if everybody else thinks differently or they've been forced to think differently. And that seems to be the main reason he's writing the diary, to stay sane and to stay human. He hopes that the diary could plant a seed of truth that will help bring down the party far into the future. Now, in 1984, he ends up being unsuccessful at that, but in real life, there was a Russian author named Alexander Solzhenitsyn. He was living in the Soviet Union, and he wrote a letter criticizing the communist leader Stalin. And because of that, he was sent for 8 years to forced labor camps. Those camps were terrible places where millions of people died over time. But after Solzhenitsyn was released from those camps, he began writing about his experiences in them. Eventually, his writing became an important force in exposing the evil side of the Soviet Union, both to the citizens of that country and to the world. In his most important book, which is called The Gulag Archipelago, he wrote, "One man who stopped lying could bring down a tyranny," end quote. So to summarize lesson 5, doublethink is accepting the party's official facts without question, even when it contains direct contradictions and it contradicts what someone is seeing in front of their eyes. For example, when Oceania changes their enemy every few years from East Asia to Eurasia and then rewrites the records, and party members must immediately accept that they've always been at war with the same current enemy. Next, we have lesson 6. Love is rebellion. Winston had a secret affair with Julia, breaking the party's rules. So part 2 of 1984 is all about Winston's secret love affair with a woman named Julia. She's working in the same building as Winston, but in the Department of Fiction. At the beginning of the book, Winston actually believed that she was a spy following him, or even a thought police. But as it turns out, she was actually in love. And one day, when he's walking down a hallway at work, she's walking past him, and then Julia pretends to slip and fall, and as Winston is helping her up, she slips a note into his hand that reads, "I love you." Winston reads it privately, and he is shocked. And then, because there's always surveillance around them, they have to be very secretive. They exchange a few whispered words in the work cafeteria, and then they arrange to meet in the countryside to escape the telescreens and Big Brother. So they arrive separately in a forest way outside the city, and they make love. Why did the love affair need to be so secret? Because the party strictly controls all relationships and forbids any promiscuity in party members. In fact, their education system tries to remove all pleasure from lovemaking. Winston was actually married many years before, and his wife, who was well brainwashed, would insist that they try to have a baby, quote, as our duty to the party, end quote, but then she would lie stiff with eyes closed during the process, and that was unbearable for him. In 1984, Winston and Julia later share some ideas of why the party controls sex so much. A first reason could be to prevent personal bonds. If men and women cannot create relationships with each other that provide them security and belonging, then they'll become more dependent on an outside source like the party. A second reason could be to redirect energy to political fanaticism. So if sexual energy cannot find a natural outlet, then that energy needs to be released in a different way. And Julia believes that's why the party members go marching and shouting in the streets, because they need an outlet for all that energy. So when in the book, Winston and Julia's affair is not just a personal act, but it's represented as a political rebellion. Part of their motivation for it was to enjoy breaking the rules of the party. However, over a few chapters, one big difference did emerge between them. Winston cared more about the party being wrong morally and philosophically, while Julia cared more about simply doing what she wanted. And that's why he told her, "You're only a rebel from the waist downwards." Later on, they broke more rules, such as renting a small room above a junk shop, the same shop where Winston bought the old diary from the first chapter. So that little room gave them a private place to meet that was more safe. The owner of that shop, Mr. Charrington, didn't seem to mind, and he probably needed the money. Another rule they broke was to enjoy real coffee and real chocolate, which were smuggled from the homes of inner party members. Because since they're both outer party members, usually the food they ate was very poor quality. Another broken rule was Julia wearing makeup and perfume, which were both forbidden. So, during all these chapters, Winston and Julia both believed that they would be caught by the thought police sooner or later. They knew that they would be forced to confess what they did through torture, but they promised not to betray each other or change their feelings for each other. They believed that that was one way they could win over Big Brother, because their heart was a place that nobody else could control. Now, I'm going to connect what's happening in this book to some psychology. Sigmund Freud is probably the most well-known psychologist of all time. 100 years ago, he was writing about how real-life societies control people's sexual impulses. And there are some strange connections that I can see between what Sigmund Freud wrote and 1984. You see, in Freud's time, the social rules around sex were much more strict than they are today in a lot of Western countries. It was only allowed inside of a monogamous heterosexual marriage. Anything outside of that was severely socially unacceptable. And so Sigmund Freud believed that societies had learned to control sexuality through rules, norms, and taboos because that sexual energy could be redirected towards channels that were more socially useful, like raising a family or working creatively. In psychology, this process is called sublimation. So basically, Freud kind of described how real-life societies did a more subtle version of what's being described in 1984, channeling the sex energy into a certain direction. You can learn more interesting ideas in our summary of Civilization and Its Discontents by Sigmund Freud on growth.me. So to summarize Lesson 6, the party controls all love relationships. They strictly forbid promiscuity and strongly discourage sexual pleasure, even within marriage, because it helps strengthen loyalty to the party. Julia, the dark-haired woman, gave Winston a secret love note, and then they began meeting. They promised never to betray their feelings for each other, even if they were caught. Lesson 7 is the Brotherhood. Winston joins a secret organization to take down Big Brother. So another important character in 1984 is O'Brien, who was first mentioned in Winston's diary. O'Brien is a powerfully built man, and he's an inner party member. But Winston suspects, or hopes, that he is secretly against the party too. Winston's suspicion here is based on just a few moments of eye contact between them, so he's not sure. But then one day, O'Brien does something very unusual. He asks Winston to visit his home to pick up a dictionary, and Winston believes it's just an excuse so that they can meet privately, and he believes that O'Brien is going to invite him to rebel against the party. And so he arrives at O'Brien's apartment with Julia with him. When they arrive, O'Brien does admit that he is part of the Brotherhood. That is the secret organization that is working to destroy the party under the leadership of Goldstein. Winston and Julia both join the Brotherhood, and they pledge to do almost anything for it. A little while after that, Winston receives a black book from the Brotherhood that explains their whole philosophy. It was written by Emmanuel Goldstein, and each chapter explains how the party works. Each chapter is titled with one of the party's three slogans. The slogans are "War is peace," "Freedom is slavery," and "Ignorance is strength." And here's what those mean. Ignorance is strength. The first chapter of Goldstein's book explains how in every society, three classes of people always emerge. A high, middle, and lower class. So in most political revolutions of the past, the middle class would combine with the lower class to overthrow the higher class. But the party had figured out how to make a society that was stable and strong through making people ignorant and carefully controlling their thinking. So basically the slogan of ignorance is strength means that by keeping people ignorant, that makes the society stronger. In other words, the higher class remains stable. The second slogan is "War is peace." Another chapter explains why the three superstates are always at war with each other. It says a perpetual war consumes any extra production of the countries, which keeps people poor, and poor people cannot revolt. In fact, all three states are basically run according to similar ideologies, and none of them really want to win the war or for the war to end, because the war is what allows the parties to remain in power. So that's why war is peace, because it also ensures that social stability that allows the party to stay in power. And the third slogan is "Freedom is slavery." So later on, in a different part of 1984, this slogan is explained. It means that a free individual is always ultimately defeated because they will die, which is the ultimate failure. But if they completely submit to the party, then they can, in a way, escape that slavery of death, because they become part of a power that will exist beyond their death, possibly forever. So by conquering their own individuality and completely submitting to the party, they can escape the slavery of freedom. That's what the slogan means. Freedom is slavery. Now there's another book. It's an amazing book called The True Believer, and it's about why people in real life wanted to join mass movements, including political, social, and religious movements. And the author of that book, Erich Hoffer, lived during the time of Nazi Germany, communist Russia, etc., so he had some great insights into the psychology of the fanatic. He believed that people join mass movements to escape a burden of freedom, especially when they no longer believe in their own individual power to accomplish something meaningful. As he wrote, quote, "The desire to belong is partly a desire to lose oneself." And he also wrote, "Faith in a holy cause is to a considerable extent a substitute for the lost faith in ourselves." End quote. And you can read more interesting ideas like that in our summary of The True Believer by Eric Hoffer. To summarize Lesson 7, O'Brien is a powerful inner party member. Through him, Winston and Julia join the Brotherhood, which secretly aims to destroy the party. They receive a black book written by their new leader Goldstein that explains how the party remains in power through constant censorship and endless war. And finally, Lesson 8, The Ministry of Love. Winston is arrested, tortured, and rehabilitated until his thinking is acceptable to the party again. So part 3 of 1984 is all about Winston's capture by the Thought Police and his experiences inside the Ministry of Love. He and Julia were suddenly captured in that rented room because the owner of that junk shop, Mr. Charrington, he turned out to be a member of the Thought Police. So they have agents everywhere. So after he was arrested, Winston was taken to a room that was white and windowless. It only had a bench and a toilet and 4 telescreens on the walls. Some other prisoners walked in and out of the room too. Winston was very surprised when one of the prisoners was his co-worker Parsons, because Parsons was one of the most obedient people he knew to the party. But what had happened is that Parsons had accidentally said in his sleep some thought crime. He said, "Down with Big Brother," while he was sleeping, and then he was reported for that thought crime by his little daughter. But because he was a true believer, Parsons said that he deserved the punishment, years in the labor camp, and he still felt proud of his daughter for her loyalty to the party. So that's kind of the psychology of the obedient party member. They believe they deserve the punishment, even if they accidentally commit thought crimes. So over many months, Winston is starved, beaten, and tortured inside of this white room that is inside the Ministry of Love. Winston says whatever the officials want him to say just to stop the pain. He confesses to many crimes that he did not even commit, and by the end, his body is like a skeleton and his teeth and hair are easily falling out. And at one point, O'Brien walks into the room. It turns out that he was working for the party the whole time, not the Brotherhood. In fact, the Thought Police had been closely watching Winston for 7 years, and they knew about everything, including the diary that he had hidden, and even what his nightmares looked like. And O'Brien personally tortures Winston for some time, saying that it's for his own good to make him sane again. And the party defines sanity as being in conformity with what other people are thinking. This situation reminds me of a scary quote from the Christian writer C.S. Lewis, who said, quote, "Of all tyrannies, a tyranny sincerely exercised for the good of its victims may be the most oppressive. It would be better to live under robber barons, aka criminals, than under omnipotent, moral, busybodies. The criminal's cruelty may sometimes sleep, but those who torment us for our own good will torment us without end, for they do so with the approval of their own conscience." End quote. So at this point in the book, O'Brien answers some of Winston's questions about the party. He admits that Big Brother is more like a mascot for the party, not a real person. He also reveals the party's true motivation, pure power. Their goal is to collectively dominate over the individual forever. a single person would never stand a chance against them. They simply had to submit. And then many more months pass, and Winston trains himself how to think correctly again. He starts to squash down any thinking he has that goes against what the party says. But deep down, he still loves Julia, and he actually plans to die hating Big Brother. He's being treated better with more food, sleep, and comfort, and he has hope of being released one day. But then he makes a big mistake. During one dream, he sees Julia, and then he cries out for her. And that is crime think. And so O'Brien comes into the room and takes Winston to a terrifying place called Room 101, which is where Winston will receive his final punishment. In this room is the worst punishment in the world, because it's personalized for each individual. For Winston, what they've created is a mask that contains hungry rats inside of it, and they will put it on his face. While they are putting on the mask, in terror, he screams for them to torture Julia instead, which finally breaks his feelings for her. And so then, in the final chapter of 1984, Winston is back in the world. He's constantly drinking alcohol, and because of that final torture, he has no more feelings for Julia. He has no more rebellion against the party. He's conquered his individuality and now loves Big Brother. So to summarize the final lesson, Winston is captured, starved, beaten, and tortured until his body is falling apart. He finds out O'Brien was working for the party all along. Finally, a rat mask torture device makes him give up his individual thinking and to love Big Brother. So let's finish up with three practical action steps how we could apply this book to our lives. Number one, we could pay attention when words are invented or redefined. In political discussions, this is an effective trick to hide the truth. For example, in the early 2000s, the fuzzy term weapons of mass destruction helped to cause a long war in Iraq because the word is not very well defined. It makes us imagine nuclear weapons when it could mean something very different. Action step two could be to beware censorship in the name of safety. The rationale for most of the frightening government controls in 1984 was social stability and the greater good. Political tyrants in history have often inflated small risks into large ones and created small groups of people as scapegoats as an excuse for them to seize more power. Action step number three is to encourage individual striving. Past collectivist movements took over societies when people failed to find meaning in their individual lives. For example, Hitler was a failed artist, as were many other top Nazi officials. They were failed creative types. So the first small step in this direction could be learning how to create small daily habits, which will eventually increase our own personal achievements and creativity. And a good place to start with that is with our summary of the book Atomic Habits by James Clear. So I hope you enjoyed this, and I'll see you in the next one.